is tape two. Now, you were reading Camus in Hattiesburg Jail, is that right? When we left off?
Particularly, I wanted to go again. He talks a lot about the terrorists and Russian terrorists in 1905. And in one sense, the fact that what he finds in them is the fact that they were able to, they accepted that if they took a life, that they offered their own in exchange, that is, that they accepted the fact of their own death, and this was what justified their taking a life. And he moves from there into the whole question of violence and nonviolence, and comes out with something which I think is relevant in this struggle, that is, in terms of violence and in terms of nonviolence, because it's a question of not having, you know, active nonviolence, he says, you know, just in general, as a general philosophy of life, is to, if you thought of as a passive thing, is something where you just subjugate yourself to the conditions that are and don't try and change them. And then the problem is to go on from there into something which is active, and yet in which the dichotomy is whether you could not be a victim anymore and not also be what he calls an executioner. That is, if between these two extremes, whether people who are victims rise up to try and change their status, then usually, historically, somewhere along the lines, they become executioners and they get involved in subjugating, you know, other people. And, of course, this doesn't apply for us on any grand scale in the sense that we're going to have a political overthrow in which we become political executioners and, you know, anything like that.
Does it apply in terms of inside attitudes, though?
It applies very much, I think. We're going through a big thing right now in the staff in terms of just attitudes of the Negro staff towards the white staff. And it's very hard for some of the students here who have been brought up here in Mississippi and have been a victim of this kind of bitterness and race hatred, not to begin to let all of that out on the white staff, you know. And we just had a tirade, one staff person, a few days ago, just, you know, for about 15 minutes, just letting out what really was a whole series of really racial statements of hatred. And we sort of all just sat to it. I mean, the white students who were, in this case, now made victims of this. And no, it's a process named cleansing. But the problem is whether you can move from one to the other. That is, whether you can move Negro people from the place where they are now victims of this kind of hatred to a place where they don't in turn become perpetrators of it, where they don't pass it on.
What are the actual criticisms? I don't mean necessarily valid criticisms, I mean the emotional impulse behind the criticism of, say, the white participants in this movement or similar movements.
Well, first, the white people come down, have better skills, have better training. They can do things that the Negroes do. that the tendency is always for them to gravitate to jobs which are in fact command posts, because office jobs, administration jobs, things like that. So the problem is to use the skills and at the same time try and pass them on, build up skills in the Negro. To have Negro students, you know, actually feeling like this is their movement. I mean, this is in a sense the strongest feeling among the Negro students, that this is one thing that belongs to them in the whole country. I mean, that this is something that they started, at least, or if they didn't start it, they picked it up and they're carrying it out, and it belongs to them. I think this is the emotional reaction behind white people coming in and participating. That is when you get the outburst, the fear of it. You know, well, here's something finally that we have, and you know, can't take this from us also. You know, even though the people who are down working, you know, they're sympathetic. They're people who are sacrificing themselves.
What about the resentment as an assumed patronizing attitude? I mean, assumed it to be held by the white worker. It doesn't matter, really.
It comes, but it's deeper than that. I mean, we have some people down who are just fine.
Well, I don't mean the people are actually guilty of it, of being patronizing. I mean, it's attributed to them by some of their co-workers, their student co-workers.
Yeah, that comes in.
At least I've heard this. I've also heard, and I ask if it's true or not, in your experience, the resentment against the white student or young white person who comes into such an environment as this movement and then tries to enter romantically into Negro mores, Negro taste in music, Negro taste in this, that, and the other, who wants to enter, to join in some subtle way, becomes more Negro than Negro.
Well, it depends. The distinction the students themselves use is whether a person is white. That is, they make distinction between white people who somehow carry their whiteness with them, that is, and some white people who somehow don't. And it's they just make that kind of distinction.
It's a mystic difference.
Yeah, they say that they don't, they're not really white people. That is, that they get along better with these people that they feel don't carry their whiteness. Somehow maybe, you know, just enter, some people just transcend that distinction and move on a plane of people, human beings.
I was referring to this, to the sense of amusement and even perhaps resentment at the white man who tries to be Negro.
Well, accepts the
Negro taste and tries to...
It depends on the... See, then they make this distinction, and the person who they consider not white in that sense, it doesn't, there's no amusement. In fact, they accept them. But the white person, that is, the person who carries his whiteness and who, in addition to that, maybe tries to move into this area, that person then becomes, say, an object for amusement, something like that. But there are some white people who do move in that way and who do it successfully, in the sense that, and the distinction that students make is that they don't carry their whiteness. It's hard to get at.
Do you find some resentment of your superior attainments and education? Do you sense it?
I don't. One thing was when I first came down, it was something that I just very consciously played down.
Well, naturally.
Yeah. so that if you establish a relationship with people at another level and they identify with you, then after they find out something like that, that becomes something that they are not resentful of, but they can become proud or something like that. So it can be transformed into a positive thing.
This is something of an ambivalence that is said to exist, I suppose it exists in all societies, it exists in the Negro society. On the one hand, a kind of jealousy or amusement at achievement, and on the other hand, a kind of identification with the achiever, the Negro achiever. At least many Negroes have written about this and have talked about it.
Well, of course, when Negro achiever then is, I mean, there's this additional problem of his achieving in the white world, particularly down here in Mississippi, because that, I mean, just means that he's an Uncle Tom, in effect, or that he has to compromise with the white world at some point, or that he isn't free, he can't, for all he's gotten, he can't now, say, participate with us, or even do the things that he wants to do, and he becomes a conservative, and the person who's trying to hold back the change, trying to hold on to what he has, trying to protect that.
The sneers one can hear directed at Ralph Bunch or, you know, Clarence Mitchell or various other people, certain writers like Ralph Ellison and people like that. These, you encounter these sneers, not, of course, you can encounter a sneer at anybody sooner or later, you know. There's no unanimous opinion, but those examples are the sort of thing I'm talking about.
I always think that most of that is due to lack of ability to understand at a more complex level and, you know, and to really understand all the different facets of society and how people, you know, get that with the acceptance of certain positions, goals, there's certain roles which are defined, and they're very, the question always is really a question which you can't answer unless you know the person up close, and it's a kind of evaluation which people want to make from a distance.
Yes.
And really then becomes an abstraction. And it's that they can't really make that kind of evaluation without getting in close and knowing that, watching some day-by-day transactions and seeing where, you know, what kind of tension that person lives under in making his decisions.
Not to take personality, just take Mr. X, you see, who is very able and enjoys a fine reputation, is distinguished in some profession or occupation. Well, naturally, he has some white friends. Now, as he has white friends with the same line of work or an associated world, how does that must build against him?
I think more than anything else, that what the kind of thing that you can say now is that it's called upon. It isn't as if Negroes who are now successful have the right to live a completely private life. That is, that the time is such that they have, I mean, it seems to me that you can ask them, that you have the duty to ask them, and even to that, what the questions about what are they doing in this big change, what public life are they, you know, are they pursuing? Doesn't have to be directly in the revolution, but if they're doctors, then the time has come for them to prepare themselves, and so that Negro people get the best medical care, and that they get it no longer because the Negroes are shoved off to one side, do they now get the same kind of treatment if they're teachers? Then the time has come for them to prepare themselves to know what's going on in the educational revolution that the country is going through, and to see that the Negro students that they are teaching now are getting real, you know, education and preparing themselves. There's so much that needs to be done that even, okay, if he's in, he's got a very successful profession and everything, that, and this is what, after all, he has the right to this, and everybody does, and the people, that's what the people want. They want to be able themselves to do that, but that now the fight is of such proportions that he also, it seems to me, you can ask legitimately, what commitment is he making to it? And not just in terms of funding or supporting, but in terms of his own profession, his own skills. How is that being used in to help the Negro along, help the whole society?
How much of a split remains between the black bourgeoisie and the masses? Is that being narrowed, that breach?
It doesn't seem to be.
It's not being narrowed, you think?
The newer Negroes coming out of school now, more of them, I think, are aware of some identification with the masses. But I think they're just most of the people who are the old bourgeoisie. I don't think that identification.
You can find, actually, resistances to the impulse toward integration. I've read several articles by Negroes, one by the president of the Business League of St. Louis, Negro Business Organization, saying integration will set Negro business back 25 years, things like that, that kind of argument. Defending the vested interest at any cost.
Well, that's the kind of thing that I'm really trying to get at before. He's got a business, maybe, so it's, he's got to compete now with the general market, and he's got to produce enough services and goods and so forth so that the Negroes themselves don't have to get a second hand in terms of getting some, that kind of service, and that if he lives up to that, then it seems to me that he won't have this kind of worry. But usually where you find the Negro businessman who's worried about that, what integration is going to do to his business, then he's usually giving the Negro a second-hand deal anyway. He's higher prices for worse products or something.
What about that split that is talked about often? I encountered first in Du Bois many years ago, between the impulse toward loyalty to Negroness, the negritude idea, the mystique noire, the sense of identification in an exclusive way, the notion of an African tradition, or at least of a shared American tradition, but an exclusive one. This precious identification, a sense of this is me, this is my identity, this is, and is outside of all other definitions. That impulse on one side, it has many forms, of course, against another impulse to move out of the tradition of Western European culture, American culture, penetrate that, and perhaps integrate with it, and perhaps in the end even have identity loss in it, physiologically and culturally. This split. Now, for some people, it's a very important problem. It's a deep problem. For others, it's not. How do you feel about it?
For myself, personally, the problem has been to find out this kind of identity is to find a broader perspective. That is, I don't feel that I'm looking, you know, that it's a problem of identifying this Negroness or this mystique or anything like that. And, you know, just historically, if you look back through the family, as far as I can trace it, and you get all sorts of elements in, there's no way of saying that, you know, this is, you know, this is belong to Negro culture, and it seems to me it evaporates. And I can, everything, Harlem, you know, my family, there are all sorts of things that mix in. Neither, however, do you want to integrate into the middle class white culture, since that seems to be, at this point, in vital need of some kind of renewal. But the, and I don't know, I think that in the struggle that we're going through here, that what's happened is that, you know, you find a broader identification, that is, that it leads to identification of the same kind of thing that other peoples and individuals have gone through, that the struggle doesn't become just a question of racial struggle, it enters into other planes, political, question of just humanitarian struggle, question of justice, and in within those, if you cut it differently like that, then you can get your picture of yourself as a person and caught up historically in these circumstances, and now your job is to try and work something out. And in the working of that out, you finally begin to get a concept of yourself as a person, and it, that whole question of needing to identify yourself as in this kind of Negro culture, or needing to become integrated into the whole white society, that disappears.
Have you encountered S.N. Udam's book on black nationalism?
No, I haven't.
It's an interesting book. He says that on one hand, the exclusiveness of the black Muslim, the withdrawal from the white devils, and the ferocious pride in being Negro, and even the dream of, you know, of imperial grandeur, which seems to be a withdrawal from white Western culture and middle class values, works out as an appeal to the concealed aspirations toward those same middle class values.
Well, I think that's true. Maybe what they want is, or what they work for, that same kind of setup, but just separate.
Just separate.
Now, there's within the student movement some people who challenge that whole setup, and they're not working at all towards that kind of setup. But then you get into the real question of the.
You mean they're not working toward the acceptance of middle class American values?
Right. That they. Be very uncomfortable in them. But then you get in the question of hope, how this is, where the society is going to go, the economy, the question of the jobs, you know, the alienation of work, people who are working on little bits of large things and don't know what it is about.
alienation from active, from work, from creative effort.
Creative effort that they just...
In that sense, it sometimes said that the Negro is the final victim of the modern alienation of a technological industrial society. He's the biggest victim, cut off most from the possibility of significant work. Mm. What about the relation, if any, between the student movement and beatism? Now, this is brought up to me first by some people associated with the student movement. Okay, so this is part of the same atmosphere that created the beats. I was shocked by this, I'll tell you, because it seemed it was a new way of looking at it to me. But I thought the beats represented something quite different. Of course, they're not a church or a club, so it's hard to know what they mean, except by analysis. What do you think of it?
I don't know. I'm not sure what that person meant. It's the same atmosphere that created it.
I tried to probe it, and I didn't get very far, except that there seemed to be some protest on the part of this speaker in this conversation. It was attributed to the beats. It was similar to the protest that the student movement has against middle-class values. But he wanted to go farther.
I don't think so. See, one thing, the beats were left without a people or without anybody that they were identifying with.
Antisocial.
Yeah. So they were reacting against everything and closing in on themselves and for their... you know, values and things like that. What happens with the students is that they're reacting against this level and identifying with these people. And I mean, the students are constantly renewed just by, you know, the people who come off the land, the farmers who are unsophisticated, but who simply voice time and time again just simple truths that people, you can't ignore because they speak from their own lives and their own personal experience, and that so that it's in this that the students are rooted in. It seems to me that it's this that keeps them from going off on some kind of real tangent. They as long as they keep working with people, are really the source, in many senses, of values which they can't refute themselves. I mean, it's this that's put in opposition to whites. Now, we at this meeting, for instance, that we had on Sunday.
Yes, I was here for a while, and I was very much struck by the quality of some of the people speaking from outlying counties. These old people particularly, you know, these old men.
Well, now, but still, see, there were some of the leadership who would say, who were against this kind of meeting.
Now, why is that?
They're for a kind of meeting where you get the well-dressed, cleaned-up Negro who has maybe some semblance of an education and who is now a leader. And he represents these people. They want these people to be represented.
Not present. In a really democratic town meeting.
Right. They don't want them. They're embarrassed by their getting up. Because maybe they don't speak English well. Maybe they grope for the word.
They say reddish for register, for instance.
Right. They can't say
it's a wonderful word, reddish.
And they were complaining about, you know, in fact, that look at all these people who are here, and look, every one of them thinks they can get up. Just anybody can get up and talk. Now, it's that kind of thing that the students are really battling against. That is the fact of that somehow people have to be cleaned up and presented before they're ready for the larger society. And this expression of that these people themselves need to be present and presented to white people just as they are, and they need, white people and the society needs to hear them, they need to listen to them. And as long as the students are, you know, are tied in with these, then I don't think that they, I mean, I think that their revolt, you know, is well based, and it doesn't, in that sense, not like the Beatnik revolt, which didn't have, you know, it seems to me that just they turned in on itself. I don't
take another tack, which involves some of the same elements. Why did communism never make any headway with the American Negro? It was a fruitful situation, one would think, both in the North and in the South.
And I don't really know that. I mean, the people that I know who, say, who are older now and who were in that move back in the 30s and the early 40s, apparently, I mean, they say that they just became disillusioned. That at one point where the communists were really not interested so much in the Negro, and I think maybe the answer to that is found somewhat in the sort of more left-wing people now who are present, current now, who have really worked out political programs or sort of set ideas about what needs to happen. When they confront, say, when they get down in this kind of situation, then the people are not really concerned with this abstract level of politics. They're concerned with more concrete level of what happens to individuals, and the progress is made in winning their allegiance in terms of if, as you struggle, you do become concerned with the individuals, and which means in a lot of cases working out compromises. That so can't say no. You know, you've got to cut all of this off because if you get bogged down with working with these individuals with this kind of problem, or trying to bring this guy along, and that, you know, you never get this up to this level that you're working for. Tendency to sacrifice people for platforms. I think that, as far as I can see, that would be one big reason.
Apparently, it happened in any case. How much was this being another white man's organization? Did that come into it? I've heard that said many times.
Maybe.
I don't know either, but I've heard it said. I saw the Negroes, this was another white man's thing.
The problem, of course, is that you really can't find out because the communist scare is such a big issue.
Now, you mean?
Now, that you don't really feel, because I wouldn't feel good talking to people that I know may have been involved. Because then, might come someday, you know, when I have to get up on the witness stand and they ask you
sure,
every time.
Yeah.
And I say now that no, I don't know, I don't know anything about it. And
keep it clean.
Keep it clean. And then they're reluctant to talk because it can be brought up against them.
Yes, sure. Tell me this, why did this movement, not merely SNCC, but the whole complex of movements, and even the activities of people outside of movements. There was the rise of the new Negro, as I said, you see, the Negro Revolt. Why did it come when it did, and say not 30 years before in the 30s, or 25 years before, take it earlier?
Of course, now my father and some of the people in his generation, they make the point that they had to come along first and prepare young people in order so that we could do the work that we're doing now. And that we have, in essence, their support and others that we have, whereas they wouldn't have had their parent support. And that, so that one reason, say, why that could have happened then was that at that time they wouldn't have had any support, that is, they would have just been cut out from under them.
There was no popular support.
No popular support, and also that as young people at that time, there was no support from the older generation. That is that, anyway, this is one kind of point he makes. Now, other people, you know, point out the whole question of the move in Africa, and the rise of an image in Africa of black people being able to control their own destiny.
You mean then the American Negro changed his self-image as a reflex from the African situation?
I think there's no question that that has some...
Certainly
with some of the key leadership. That is, that that they were struck and greatly influenced by those movements.
Would there have been enough educated Negroes 30 years ago to mount this vast organizational effort and to spearhead it, to give it its cutting edge that it has now?
I don't know. Maybe not.
I was just trying to get you to assess what have been the educational and cultural gains that one generation.
Of course, sir. I think they...
Concealed gains, you know.
Right. And I think it seems to me that all of these sprung up out of World War II, with the Negro, that it was. Of course, we were picked up and moved into that rapid advance class. I've been thinking back, you know, why, what happened. It seemed to me that it was in the late 40s when I was in junior high school, and they started that rapid advance, and that was part of a move around the country to begin to provide educational opportunities for Negroes in the North, for a conscious move for able students to begin to open up doors which had previously been closed for them. And going to Hamilton was simply a part of that, as the special money was available, and they were looking now for Negro students, and it was part of the move to begin to provide some education. And all of those things, the gains of World War II, I think, in terms of the Negro in the North, they needed people to work. They had, and so then they were subsumed into a higher standard of living. So that laid the basis for it, too. There's no question about that. The Supreme Court decision made another kind of basis for it.
I've heard it said to the Negroes that the war experience itself,
and
being
no question,
integrated first, not being integrated units, and then being integrated units, these contrasts were very significant.
And also, there's no question about the fact of the returning back to the South after being in the war and fighting and so forth, and having to come back to the same situation that left, I think, just a real residue of bitterness for many, many of the soldiers. And, you know, they weren't ready to be humiliated anymore.
What about the change in climate of general opinion, say, including white opinion now, not just a change in Negro attitudes, a Negro situation, but a change in the climate? The spiritual climate, the emotional climate, the intellectual climate over that period of 25, 30 years. How much is that to be taken into account? I don't mean as the explanation, but I mean as part of this complex of factors.
Well, it's hard. It seems to me that the change in climate, that what they said, I don't really know, but if trying to assess the people, say, who have position in the overall society for really affecting change. It seems to me what they said was, well, we've got to be able to give them a chance to do something on their own. That is,
say it again, will you please? They being whites.
Whites. Now that is that it was opened up to extend. And this is really what the Supreme Court decision did. Didn't integrate the schools or anything. It gave Negroes the legal basis and the moral basis for fighting in the overall society to integrate the schools. And so they're carrying on the fight. I mean, this happened, I think, in terms of the education end of it. That is, that the feeling was, well, it has to be the climate that happened in the white community was that, well, if they're going to participate in society, then certainly they must have leadership. They must, I assume, they realized that white people were not going to do it. They weren't going to lead them. And so then, therefore, I think some move towards at least trying to prepare people, get people, open up opportunity and so forth. I don't know that there was any feeling of preparing people for what now has happened, I'm sure.
I asked the same question of a very able Negro lawyer who's been very active in civil rights. And he burst out, there's been no change. It's always been the same. He added here, it's more interested in the black Muslim movement. The last man you expect, you see, given the objective aspects of this life. There's been no change. It's always the same. He didn't use the word quite devil, but he said he's the way black brothers are more and more interested in their point of view.
I mean, for instance, at Hamilton, it seemed to me that the attitude, the difference, the change in attitude was that, well, we have to do our part in the society as it's overall problem, which was realized and brought to the fore during World War II. Our part as an educational institution is to try and open up a door or two for some Negroes, and let's see what happens. Now, the difference was before was they weren't really interested in even trying to open up the door to see what would happen. They were apprehensive about what might happen, about, you know, getting the wrong person up there and having it fail and that kind of thing. And while I was up there, you know, I was glad to have that opportunity, but still deeply bitter about some of the realities of the campus and some of the realities of the white attitude. That is, they were willing to go so far, but not any further. But that in itself, I think, was the kind of change that took place in many places around the country. That is, that we've got at least to open up one or two doors and try it. Now you're getting, you know, you're getting a different kind of change now. That is, people are seriously looking to see. I think everything happens through pressure. I mean, that is that all of it's always a pressure from underneath which forces people to realize that they have to do some kind of changing.
Yes, if nothing changes, nothing changes.
Right.
The conception of the Negro from 1865 to the present, the white man's picture of the Negro has changed, hasn't it? Through pressures of all sorts.
Sure. sure it has. Even down here, down, even in Mississippi, you get it. Burlington, the sheriff in Canton told some of our fellows they are planning Freedom Day activity there coming at the end of this month, and he told them, well, you all are fighting for what you believe is right, and you're going to fight. We are fighting for what we believe is right. And we're going to fight also. Now, that seems to me a tremendous change.
It surprises me, to tell you the truth.
That's a recognition that of an equal status. That is, you a person who's now all of a sudden they can realize that here, these are people, and these are, now these guys are up there, they're not particularly well educated or anything like that. They're just from the South, Negroes, born and raised down here. And here he's saying that, okay, you have something that you believe in, they recognize us finally. And what we have something we believe in. So we're on both sides, either side of the fence, and we're going to just fight this thing out. Now that seems to be a tremendous kind of change.
And the sheriff is not a man of, I suppose, much education.
No.
Or much experience outside of this county.
Outside of this county.
If he says this, it must reflect something that's happened in the county itself.
Exactly. It's just tremendous movement among Negro people, you know, and organizing. It's gotten to the point there, I understand, they just raised all of the electric bills in New York. And just across the board, raised everybody's light bill. But it's a tremendous struggle that's taking place. But then part of it is the recognition by the white man that there is a struggle, and that Negroes themselves are struggling.
What about Freedom Day in Canton, say, what would it be like? What is the nature of the program projected there?
That there will be some, we're trying to get the National Council of Churches to get involved with another group of ministers. Then probably have another picket line downtown. And
this involved boycott?
They're having a boycott
now.
They're having one now, so that's already part of the picture.
How effective is it being now?
Well, that's the boycott. I guess is fairly effective, but it's just that's going to be very bitter. No question about it.
Bad trouble?
Yeah.
Did you find any irony, even a mild irony, in the fact of the march on Washington being erected at the Lincoln Monument? Lincoln being, in what the sense of Lincoln being, declared racist. As everybody knows.
No, I guess the fact is that just in terms of popular projection, but in...
For popular projection, it's useful.
Right.
Just an image.
Right.
But the reality. In your own mind, how would you reason this out?
Well,
justify the going, not on tactical grounds, but on other grounds, to Lincoln's money.
Well, in just that, the sense that this was a popular march. That it was March, you know, that it was for people, you know, it was for people who are not so much...
Who don't know American history.
Right, that's true. And who...
But you do know American history, so you have to make some terms with it. I mean, one has to make some terms with it. In what sense can one make terms with that fact? Pretend to have any answer in the back of the book, mind you. I just recognize this. Some people think it is a problem. And some people have answers based on relativism of historical values. Or relativism of values in history as opposed to absolute values.
Didn't bother me. I mean, I was concerned, I guess, more concerned with other things about that march.
The practical side, yes. I mean now,
but
in conversation.
I
mean,
really hadn't crossed my mind.
He's a very tepid emancipationist to begin with, and then a total racist. And here, the great march on Washington is in the shadow of his monument. Goes to his monument. He's a shrine. Now, by the way, Lincoln's a hero of mine. I'm not trying to set up a way to kick Lincoln in the shin, you see. That's the point.
I'm afraid I draw a blank on that.
Draw a blank on that one. What I'm getting at is simply repeating what a Negro I was talking to some time back said, paraphrasing roughly, he said it very well, that history proposes issues in the terms possible in that moment of history.
Mm.
That the problem of racism was not proposed by history at that time. And another historian I was talking to said, my God, there wasn't a man on that continent who was not a racist. The whole notion of attacking the concept of racism is recent. It's not a relevant comparison.
Well, it didn't say anything cross my mind.
Well, this is just raise a little sort of a fable of something. It ties into the question of whether the white man's attitudes have changed, you see, in this 100 years. Where the abolitionists were racist to the bone, too. Yes, they were not concerned with abolishing racism as a concept or even a practice. They were concerned with something else. I suppose it varied from case to case, but it was not an attack on the theory of racism or the attitudes of racism. So you're a sheriff in Canton. What county is that? I forget.
Madison County.
You're a sheriff in Madison County is less of a racist than Abraham Lincoln. Which is a strange little quirk in history, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me this, what is meant by freedom now? In the time context, we know that all social changes involve time, more or less time. Or as Hancock says, the Negro historian sociologist, there are no such thing that as absolute and immediate solutions for social questions. Put that concept over against freedom now. How do you give flesh in history to the concept freedom now?
I don't know that that's a concept.
Well,
it's an emotional expression.
It's not a concept.
It's a feeling. It's an attempt to communicate.
I see.
I think it's we got a poster in our office with All it says is now.
I saw it.
And it's kind.
I saw it.
That's to say, people, this is how we feel. This is, you know, this is the urgency of this. I think it's an attempt to communicate a sense of urgency. That is, that this
yes.
is how urgent the problem is.
It's a poetic statement.
Right.
I asked a student at Negro University this question some time back, and he said, well, it's ridiculous to think that any changes are not in time and they're not in a process, not immediate catastrophic events.
Mm.
He says, but I can't bring myself to say it.
Mm.
There's a strip right there, but
right.
you see, the emotional demand and his hard sense of social process.
And what it's linked up to is the fear that the white person and the people who run the society are going to take as much time as you give them. That is, and that they will always stall for time and will always say, God, it takes time.
As they will use the concept of social process as a tactical device for delay.
For delay. That's a question of, right? And so then it acts as a, for instance, very interesting to watch Atlanta right now, because Atlanta, while it has its image and everything, now is the newspapers in Atlanta are making distinction between what they called on the radio, I think, the Doves and the Hawks. And the Hawks are the people out asking for instant equality, freedom now. And now they're siding with the elements in the civil rights movement who are ready to work for social change over a period of time, something like that. So, and they're focusing all their criticism on the people who are saying freedom now. Well, that's fine in a sense, because 2 or 3 years ago they were focusing all their criticism on the people who were saying we need to work some of these things out, you see. And now, okay, these people now move them up and they're agreeing with them. We've got to work these things out, and now they take it out and people say now.
Well, that is associated with the question of the brinksmanship of violence, isn't it? The threat of potential violence can be used for social for peaceful change. I borrowed a phrase from some of the speakers at Howard University.
Yeah, except that.
Who advocated this, you see. Play with the possibility. Keep it just at the boiling point. We don't need to boil over the pot if you can avoid that.
Well, the two distinctions here. One is that first, Lester Dunbar, Southern Regional Council. Lester Dunbar,
yes.
At Southern Regional Council. He has an image which he uses. He calls it the annealing of the South. He says that what you described is that there's a process whereby towns, communities are heated up. And in the process of this heating up, they can be remolded. And then during the cooling off periods, this remolding takes place and they go back to a different level or a different form. And then they're heated up again to get over another stage and things like that. And that this is what takes place. Now, this in fact takes place. It's another thing to say that, to talk about brinksmanship in the sense of consciously, you know,
one's descriptive and one's prescriptive.
Right, and I personally don't. I mean, I don't believe in that this should be prescribed. That is, we're involved right in this now because we're planning a huge summer effort, maybe involving up to 1,000. Students and people to work in Mississippi across the summer.
For the registration program.
We'll have freedom schools and community centers. There'll be some political activity, people running for Congress, carrying out this freedom registration, getting ready to challenge the Mississippi Democratic Party.
You mean really running for Congress, or like a gubernatorial
No, really running. We plan that some people will enter in the primaries, the Democratic primaries, and then also if run again in the as an independent in the general election. But and there are two ways of looking at this. That is, one way is that this is brinksmanship, and you are it's really psychological. Similar that this is, you know, you play with this to bring a community or the state or whatever up to this point, and under this threat, you get some change.
But the threat is not one of violence. You offer no threat of violence.
No.
You may get some, but you're not offering it.
Right. The threat is that the community will be a breakdown, and rather than face such a possibility, that the people will capitulate and give in some. The difference, I think, is well, the other feeling is that it's inevitable. That is, that if the change doesn't come about, unless you're really to face this risk. And again, this comes back, I guess, to that we feel, you know, that we ourselves personally are facing the same risk, that is, we're not asking anybody to face the risk that we're not facing. So that in that sense, it's justified. Or
as you are, but you're not proposing the risk of violence. You are running the risk of violence by way of reprisal or repression.
That this is part of the risk that you take, and that it, at every point what you balance out is the risk against the possibility of change, and you realize that, and you tell the people that this is the, what's open to them is the need for this kind of sacrifice, and that they have to run the risks of this if they want real change. What I'd like to get away from is the idea of a few people sitting down and manipulating.
Yes.
And the pressure on a campaign which involves a whole mass of people and bringing them somehow to this point.
Cut this moment. Just a new tape.